Zoanna looked into her crystal and smiled. The war was going so much better than she had anticipated. Here, the Moor forces were already at the Caps, and the Hermans and the Lester forces less than half a day from joining them. It would soon be all up for the witch and the brats. She then turned her focus to Helba. The old woman didn't look as though she had power, lying in bed, turning, tossing, covered in sweat, her gaunt familiar sitting by her on a chair, staring at her from wild yellow eyes. Only the intercession of that familiar had saved her life on the battlefield. The Howcat had lent her enough of its life force to sustain her until she was brought back to the palace doctor.
I could destroy you right now, Helba. I know enough now, and if need be, I can always return to college. But I don't think I have to now. I don't think you're a menace.
Contentedly, Zoanna blanked the crystal with a directed thought.
Oh, Helba, I'll keep you alive until I defeat you. And maybe for a short time after. I need to learn, and Roforth needs his amusements. Maybe I can make you seem young and pretty, so that he'll enjoy your screams even more. Sadism is always better with an attractive and innocent-seeming subject.
Lester stood holding on to the slim tree trunk and watched his men ride over the rise. A scout rode back accompanied by his second-in-command, Lieutenant Klumpecker.
We've driven them off, Commander, and St. Helens Hermans are meeting our own men.
The Caps?
Less than a day's march away.
St. Helens?
I haven't seen him, but the boy who is his friend, the former king of Eretex, is wounded.
Bad?
I can't say. I wasn't that near.
We can take the Caps in 2 days.
Probably, Commander.
Good.
Holding that thought, he gradually loosened his grip on the sapling and let his knees buckle with him all the way down to the sweet, sweet grass.
Commander! Commander Crumb!
John found himself in a lighted chamber surrounded by men in uniforms. The uniforms were familiar because they had the same cut, if not the color, of the uniforms worn by the soldiers of Hud. He looked at Cayan, held by two of the soldiers, disarmed. His own arms were similarly taken. With regret, he watched the soldiers go through his pack.
King Hooforth will be interested.
King Hooforth of what country?
Silence, prisoner. You will speak when spoken to.
This was exactly as it had been in Hud. Only, of course, this could not be the frame where there was a kingdom named Hud or a kingdom named Rudd. It would have a name that would be similar, and much else would be similar, but not identical.
We'll take them to the capital. King Hooforth will put them in a dungeon, torture them a little, and get answers from them before throwing them away.
The officer pulled his right earlobe. It was a round ear, similar to the others here. Once it had seemed that round ears were a sign of special qualities, but now it was apparent that their shape was all that distinguished them.
Now, out!
Pushing Cayan and himself ahead of them, the soldiers emerged from the wall of rock. Kelvin stepped out of the transporter closet into an empty chamber. Cayan and his father were nowhere in sight. Yet they must have come here. Should he stay in search, or go back and ask the square ear's advice? He decided to have a look outside. This seemed to be the frame of the silver serpents, but wasn't quite right. There wasn't the dust he remembered. Of course, that could mean that this was the right frame and that others had since been here. He crossed the chamber and walked through the shimmering golden curtain under the glowing exit sign. Outside, the cliff behind his back, he saw the tree and the ladder he expected. Only the ladder was down into the tree now, and it had been pulled up. He frowned, wondering, and then his gauntlets began to tingle. Obeying them as much as his own thoughts, he drew his sword and whirled. A uniformed man, half in and half out of what appeared to be solid rock, was about to strike him on the head with a short club. His sword confronted the man.
Freeze! How many of you in there?
Just two. Me and Bert.
Tell him to come out. Slowly, without a weapon.
You hear that, Bert? He's got a sword against my gullet. Don't be a hero, Bert. I'm your friend, and the commanding officer isn't.
Bert came through the rock unarmed.
Where are my friends? Do you have them?
Those two men? On the way to the king's dungeon.
King? What king?
King Hooforth, of course.
King of what country?
King of the Kingdom of Skard.
Tell me, is there an outlaw somewhere in the desert by the name of Jack?
Jack? You mean Scarface Jack?
Enemy to the king?
But what else? An outlaw has to be, no matter what else.
Skin thief?
Skin? I don't know what you're...
Silver.
I know he's robbed, but...
It doesn't matter. Tell me, can anyone in this frame levitate?
You mean fly? Well, Muvar is said to have flown.
Good enough. Turn your backs.
The two men obeyed him, and he wasted no time in activating the levitation belt. He rose above their heads and above the cliffs that towered higher than he remembered, then moved out over the tree and the river. The river was much broader than the rivers in the other frames. Down below was the first of the connected valleys, Serpent's Valley, home of great silver serpents and their spiritual brothers, the dwarf Flop-Ears. He looked close, but saw no serpents. How familiar the country looked. How very familiar. He flew at near minimum speed into the desert. At home, they called this land the Sadlands, while in Hud, it was the Barrens. In Scud, it would be called something equally appropriate. Moving his fingers carefully on the control levers on the belt's buckle, he came to a stop in midair and descended until his feet touched sand. Nothing moving now, as it had been while he was aloft. He was once more on solid earth, and so his thoughts were grounded too. Ahead was the camp. Horses, men moving. If they had not seen him in the air, they would spy him now. Even as he thought this, two horses approached. As they came nearer, he recognized the riders as men he had known, though, of course, these were not the same.
Stranger, who be you? Quick, or die!
That was poor, unfortunate Smith, who had died such a ghastly death.
I have business with your leader.
My leader?
Scarface Jack. He is your leader, isn't he?
Walk into camp. I'll be watching you.
As they neared the camp, they emerged from tents almost as though by magic. Jack among them. He really was a Scarface, with a scar that was twice the size and ugliness of Cheeky Jack's, the one-time bandit of the Sadlands. He waited for Kelvin to speak.
I'm Kelvin Knight Hackleberry. I need your help to rescue some friends of mine.
Why?
Their captors are the King's men. My friends and I can help you defeat the King's men. You see, we're from a different frame.
From a different frame, and you want to help us defeat King Hooforth, Scud's good and proper king? Is why do you want to do that, and why do you think I'd be interested?
In the other frame, your king was a tyrant and had to be replaced. Isn't he a tyrant here as well?
At that moment, the first woman Kelvin had seen came from a tent and walked straight to Jack. She put her face against the bandit's brawny arm and looked up adoringly. It was Lonnie, or at least her duplicate. The girl Kyan wanted to marry.
You call our king a tyrant? You want him overthrown?
It may be that I do not understand. In a world nearly like this one, there was a king who was very bad. In that world, an outlaw named Jack fought and conquered him.
You would have me commit treason?
I'm not here to start trouble. But if your sovereign resembles this other, you must want to be rid of him.
I must I?
This had to be a mistake. Kelvin fingered the controls on his belt and instantly was high above the bandits' heads.
Hey, you come down here!
Kelvin climbed to a suitable elevation, then moved the lever forward for full speed. He was just in time. Even at this rate of motion, he saw the arrows and crossbow bolts come perilously close. He sped away across blank desert, then swung to the east. He would catch up with the king's party himself. Down below, the road that led, if the geography of this frame did not diverge too far from the frames he remembered, to the royal palace. There was a big cloud of dust. He slowed, hovered, and tried to make out what was happening. There were horses prancing, swords were flashing, men were dying.
Gods! A battle!
He lowered himself silently, trusting that the combatants would be too involved to look up. In the swirling dust, he saw his father and brother kept back by guards wearing the Scud uniform. More uniformed soldiers were battling men who wore no uniforms at all, but were clad much as were the bandits in the desert. Those who fought the soldiers must be the good guys. But were they? Uncomfortably, he thought of the encounter he had just had. Similar frames were deceptive in their dissimilarities.
I can't take anything for granted. Just because they are taking Father and Kyan to the palace doesn't necessarily mean harm to them.
But he was almost sure it did. Something about the way the soldiers had acted at the cliffs convinced him that the royal side just couldn't be the right side. Skillfully, he moved the lever. When he was precisely at the right spot, he cut off the belt power completely. He dropped sword and gauntleted hand like a heavy stone. He was about to join the fray. Charlaine saw the dust clouds ahead and heard the battle. She galloped forward. A moment later, she was at the crest of the hill and saw a swordsman. His sword blade was raised high and caught the bright rays of the sun here above the dust clouds. In a moment, he would reach her, and that blade would lop off her head.
Whoa, Nelly!
The Cant soldier could see her plainly, could see that she was a woman and unarmed. The soldier's horse slowed. The young man, hardly older than Kelvin, but more heroically formed, stared at her, mouth agape. The sword hesitated. His blue eyes, cold but still youthful, studied her. Then, as abruptly as he had appeared, he lowered the sword, sheathed it, and rode away. She waited until the battle sound diminished and the dust settled in the valley. Soldiers in Cant's uniform sped past her on lathered horses. Below, the color of the uniforms resolved themselves into Hermione's muddy clay and Calvinia's forest green. The side that she had expected to win this battle had, in fact, won. She was still waiting when the Hermione soldier approached her on horseback. Following after fleeing Cant's warriors, he had spotted her and turned. Now he rode forward deliberately. He was a big man with hair on his face and a cruel set to his mouth. When he stared into her eyes, she knew instinctively that he would not be dissuaded as easily as the first had been. She was not certain what she should do, so she merely waited. What would happen. It might be a quick end or a lingering one.
Wait, Private!
The young man wore mail over his uniform of a Kelvinian guardsman. He was covered head to toe with battle dust. The quarter moon painted on his helmet proclaimed him officer, though she did not know the rank.
Lomax! You want up first?
I don't like your tone, Private. I know this woman.
Do, huh? I suppose that means you want her all for yourself.
Without warning, the Herman's sword swung at the guardsman, but Lomax ducked aside and sustained a bright, coppery slash on his left shoulder. The mail he wore protected him, but barely. His own sword snaked out and speared the Herman through the throat.
Mrs. Hackleberry, Kelvin's mother.
Why, yes. But how do you know? We've never met, have we?
We have met, but a long time ago. Remember when you read cards for people? You told me I'd be a soldier and do many brave deeds. I thought you were wrong, and my mother thought you wrong. But then we had our war for freedom, and afterward, I became a guardsman for King Rufert. Today, as you see, I'm a soldier, wearing Hermandy mail.
You and your mother? She wanted to know if you'd finish school, and I said yes. Then I saw the other, the battle card, and I had to say...
And you told her my father would die and she'd remarry. You were right.
The cards were right. The cards that unfortunately can only indicate. They could not have told me how your father was to die or when, or if there was a way of saving him.
Nothing's perfect. The cards indicated, and they were correct.
It is always thus. There is nothing truer than prophecy.
Why are you here, Mrs. Hackleberry?
It isn't Mrs. Hackleberry any longer. Hal and I are divorced.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear it.
Don't be. It was in the cards. I feared that he would meet an early death, and I'm happy he didn't. It was only his love for another woman that ended our marriage. It could have been much worse. But as to why I am here...
That too was in the cards?
Yes.
We have many wounded. Our only doctor was killed. Could you possibly help?
I'm not skilled. I'll do what I can.
She followed him, detouring around a horse and a man that were beyond help. They reached the bottom of the hill as the daylight faded and the sun eased down.
This way, Mrs. Knight.
Charlaine will do.
Lomax pulled back the tent flap, and there, lying on a blood-soaked blanket, was what appeared to be a schoolboy. The lad's eyes were glassy and filled with terror and suffering.
A witch! A witch!
Not a witch, Philip. This is Charlaine, Kelvin's mother.
Don't let her touch me! Don't let her! Go away! Burn her, Lomax! Burn!
Hurriedly, Charlaine grabbed his wrist. There was still a heartbeat, but it was faint. A lot of his blood was missing.
Why is he here?
He's St. Helen's friend, former king of Aratex.
Ah, is there blood fruit around?
There is, back away in the forest.
I'm not sure he can swallow the juice, but...
We'll make him. St. Helens wouldn't like it if he died.
St. Helens is captured?
Yes, or dead. He could be in the same state as this. Philip here killed the witch.
Helba, killed?
Yes, he wasn't supposed to.
But Helba is a good witch.
But on the other side, that's how the enemy got St. Helens. We broke the truce and they seized him.
Can you get the blood fruit? A lot of it. If you have other wounded who have lost blood, it could save their lives.
I'll send some men back. It's a big grove, but a long ride. They might not be able to get the fruit back until daybreak.
That will have to do. Are there wounded to whom I can give immediate help?
Many. Some not this bad.
I'll need help setting bones and severing limbs. Get me your doctor's supplies.
It was nearing dawn when the riders Lomax had dispatched arrived back with the blood fruit. At her direction, the fruit was boiled and the red syrup cooled and administered. First, young Philip. Then, man after man, weakly swallowed a spoonful or a cupful, depending on his need. In a surprisingly short time, pale faces flushed and men were restored to full vigor. It was magic fruit, the blood fruit. The doctor had had the foresight to see it gathered. But, in the fighting, the wagon with the fruit was set ablaze and destroyed. The doctor had died trying to put out the fire. So until this new supply arrived, wounded men had continually died. At first, she did not recognize him. She had only met him twice, and that under better circumstances. But then the pale, big man she was working on gasped a word, and the word caused her astonishment and joy.
John!
Lester. This was Lester, her daughter's husband. He had lost a lot of blood, but he should be all right once the syrup took effect. Revived by the prospect, she held a brimful cup to his lips and massaged his throat to force him to drink.
You'll be all right, Lester. You will be, for John's sake.
John's husband was dying, and she didn't know how she could save him. Yet there had to be a way of restoring him. There had to be. Desperately, she checked through the doctor's bag, containers of herbs properly labeled, but often a mystery to her. She wished she had absorbed more herbal lore. When in doubt, ask the cards. Without hesitation, she took the deck from her pack, shuffled it, and thought of Lester. Then, head swimming, body protesting more than the disapproving glances of assistants, she dealt out the column. A single pawn card representing Lester. A new card representing Lester's fate if she did nothing. It was the death card, skull and crossbones. Tell her something she did not already know. She dealt again. She laid out the card, there on the bloody canvas. The Lester pawn. Now administer the sealant root, and his fate would be the death card. Her hands shook as she rifled the cards and started the third layout. This time it was the Lester pawn card and the thought of the stitching flower. She held a jar of pink blossoms in her left hand, concentrated. She turned up a card. Death card.
No, no, no!
There had to be a restorative. She checked the labels on the jars. Here was a jar filled with white flower blossoms, well dried. But this couldn't be the stitching flower. Yet it was. What then were the pink blossoms in the jar she had held as she turned the card? She read the label, her tired eye squinting hard.
Stretching flower.
Quickly, she tried a fourth layout, holding the jar of white blossoms, pawn card representing Lester Crum, her daughter's husband. Now I will administer the blossoms of this jar and the sun, with a smiling face, recovery card. Lester would recover if she got the herbal medicine inside him in time. How to administer it? She didn't know, but she had to be swift. Hastily, she unscrewed the jar, shook dried blossoms into a cup, added water and a few drops of raspberry wine, stirred it, and held it to Lester's lips. She massaged his throat, edging up the cup.
John. John. I love you, John. I want you close. Please, John, come to bed.
Hush, son. It's only your old biddy mother-in-law.
Thank you.
St. Helens kept his eyes barely slitted and pretended to sleep. Suddenly, moisture trickled down on the back of his neck, the side of his face, and on his head.
You brats! You filthy brats!
At the window, two young faces with golden crowns above peered down, grinning.
That got him, Kildum. You're right, Kildee. Guess this is where we should come next time we have to pee. We can fill up with appleberry juice, come with a big load, make him smell sweet.
You brats are going to be in trouble. You can't do this to a general. You're going to be punished. When I get out, I'll warm your butts.
Listen to him, Kildum. He thinks he's getting out. Never, Kildee. He'll be here forever. Every day we'll come water him like an ugly weed. Until the whole cell fills up with appleberry pee. And him swimming in it like a big fat frug. He's already got a big fat frug face.
You brats! You filthy brats!
Do you think, Kildum, that there's another form of elimination? Plant? plants need fertilizer as well as water, don't they? Shit! Yes, let's!
Up in the window, he saw that he was being mooned by a plump posterior. Only it wasn't going to stop at that.
What's going on here?
Abruptly, the bare posterior got covered, but the brat remained standing before the window as if trying to conceal it.
Nothing, Helba. Boys, boys, you know better than to act like hooligans. You're going to have to apologize.
Oh, we were just having fun, Helba.
I'm sure it wasn't fun for General Riley. Now come away from there this instant.
The young faces looked down at his sullenly, then disappeared. He waited, but the witch did not take their place. Apparently, she hadn't come here to torment him further, difficult as that was to believe. The witch's familiar appeared, however. The howcat stared unblinkingly at him and at the interior of the cell, then flicked his tail and left without any sign of mischief.
Witches! How I hate the lot of them!
Later, though not by much, the guard opened the dungeon door and motioned him out. Meekly, mindful of the drawn sword and the fact that he had virtually no chance to fight his way out of here, even if he should manage to overcome this guard and take his sword, he climbed the stairs. On the way up, to his astonishment, the two young kings sped past him on the way down. Both boys carried a big bucket of sudsy water, a scrubbing brush, and a broom. Outside, warmed by the sun and inviting, was a large tub of soapy water. St. Helen stripped and bathed. After a thorough cleansing and soak, he saw the guard motioning him out. The man even tossed him a towel. While he was toweling, the guard brought him loose prisoner clothes to replace the lousy uniform. He felt remarkably good, he thought, while dressing. He turned, and there were the two kings, both red in the face. Their heightened color went well with their brickish hair and the plans he was making.
We apologize, General Riley, sir. We'll never come to your window again.
St. Helens nodded his head in a curt gesture of acknowledgement. The brats disappeared. St. Helens was returned to his cell. He stood and gaped at the door. The cell had been scrubbed spotless. Fresh straw had been provided. What magic might have been done readily, the young kings had evidently done laboriously.
Good gods, she really is a good witch!
Immediately, Kelvin was confronted by a burly royalist swinging down at him, and the right gauntlet countered for him and quickly ended the man's life.
Kelvin, watch out!
But already the gauntlets were blurring as they moved, transferring sword to left hand, ending another attacker's life. Now one of the royalist attackers was before him, his ally. It was a big man dressed in the plainest of clothes. Morton Crumb. No, not his friend and John's father-in-law, but this frame's very close lookalike. He focused on the man's round pink ears, neither bearing as much as a scar, and that alone kept him from shouting the name.
You? Fight against the king?
I fight to save my friends!
Come!
He maneuvered the horse with sure gauntleted hand and fought his way at the big man's side until they were directly opposite the prisoners. Kyan and his father had their hands tied behind their backs, and that could complicate the problem of getting them away. The royalist guards might have been ordered to slay them rather than give them up.
Father! I think we'd better retreat!
It was the Lester lookalike who had just pushed in. With him was a younger fighter, the exact lookalike of Philip, former boy king of Aratex, except for his round ears.
Help me release them first!
We're losing too many men.
You help us now, we'll help you later. We have things you may not have. We're from another frame!
I thought as much. I saw you flying down. But we can't help you if you're dead. If you've got power, use it!
Kelvin nudged the control in his belt. He rose to just over the heads of the combatants. The fighting stopped. It was only a temporary halt, he knew. In a moment, the novelty would be absorbed and the slaughter would resume. He nudged the control forward. The guards' faces came nearer, and so did those they guarded. They stared open-mouthed, amazed at what they had been too busy to see when he arrived. In a moment more, someone would think of a crossbow or other projectile weapon that could spell his doom. But with surprise to his advantage and the gauntlets on his hands, he had his chance. Quickly, he disarmed the guard who raised his sword at him, then descended and stabbed the remaining guard through the throat. A moment later, he was slicing through first his father's and then his brother's bonds while renewed fighting raged ahead of him. Now then, how to get out? The gauntlets knew how. Without his quite willing it, the magical grippers captured the reins of a warhorse. At their urging, he vaulted into the saddle.
Father! Kyan, up!
They extended their hands to him, and the gauntlets pulled them up on the horse.
This is going to be difficult. We're surrounded.
Kelvin's gauntlet snatched a passing sword and handed it to his father.
Thanks. But do you think...
I'll clear a path. You follow. Close.
With that, Kelvin lifted free of the saddle and just over their heads. Then he pushed the forward lever and flew to meet a royalist riding down on them. The attacking royalist died, and so did several others as Kelvin fought horselessly and airborne to open his side of the crowd. Finally, the last of the royalists melted from in front of his wild flying attack. There was the big fellow, and the big fellow's son, and the boy, and half a dozen others whose faces had a familiar look. They looked up at Kelvin.
Now you can retreat, and take us with you.
Thank the gods that's over. Follow us.
They raced up out of what would have been the pass between the Twin Valleys and the world of the Silver Serpents. Up the roads and into the hills, and finally their pursuit lost to a familiar-seeming region of farms and villages. Here, the big leader of the far smaller band raised his hand and drew up.
Whoa! Time for a talk. Marvin Loaf. You strangers have any trouble with that name?
Not a bit.
Good. Something Marvin, a peculiar name.
No more so than mine, Kelvin Hackleberry. And this is my father, John Knight. And my brother, Kyan Knight.
Well, this is my son, Hester. And this young fellow we call Jillip.
As in Lester and Philip. Good enough.
We call ourselves Loaf's Hopes. Sometimes loafers. We haven't been doing much raiding lately. After 2 years of trying to force a change, this is all we have.
Kelvin saw what he meant. 8 men in all, 2 of them with slight wounds. The rest, who had been in the fight, were dead or had been captured by the royalists.
Your king is bad?
The worst. He has to be overthrown. How, I can't now imagine.
With our help.
That flying harness of yours should help, but I'm not sure it's enough. There's really only us 8.
There will be more. All you have to do is get the word out once you've got your army.
Army? What army? I tell you, we're only 8.
If you haven't got huge serpents here that shed skins of purest silver, you have dragons that have scales of purest gold.
Serpents with silver scales? Dragons with golden skins?
Oh, my mistake. I told you we're from another frame.
That must be a distant one. Silver serpents. Golden dragons. These are legend. Nothing like them can possibly exist.
Look.
Kelvin unsheathed the Muvar weapon.
This is something very special. It will nullify hostile magic and even turn the magic back on its sender.
Magic? Magic is myth.
Look, all 3 of us can fly with this belt. We can hover still in the air, as you saw, or move at the speed of a fast horse. That should be some help. It was back there in the battle we just fought.
Back there, I lost over half my men. Is that belt all you've got?
Father! Father, he wants to help.
Good intentions don't defeat tyrants. Armies defeat tyrants.
We overthrew tyrants in 2 worlds nearly identical to this. And we need to. We can travel back to those worlds and get what we need there to deal with this tyrant.
You think so, do you?
If we have to, we'll bring you weapons you don't have. Maybe an army.
Listen to him, Father. Listen.
You've come here without our asking. And now you'd leave and we'd never see you again.
That's not true.
Listen, Sonny. We've been this route before. We've had visits from other frames so often that the king has men watching the transporter. One thing we've learned, visitors are trouble.
But Father, he can't know.
No, I don't know. I don't know about your prior visitors. You have a kingdom where you can hire mercenaries, haven't you?
We have that, Sonny, but we certainly haven't got golden dragons, silver serpents, or magic. Neither do we have riches.
But you do have round ears. You can use the transporter.
Not for a mountain of gold.
I don't mean you personally, but at least one of you. Maybe Hester here.
The king's men guard the transporter. And even if we got there, I couldn't use it.
With my help?
No.
Why not? Round ears means you can use the transporter.
No way, Sonny. There's more than the shape of ears involved.
But...
Let me explain it, Sonny. Whenever any of us natives enter the transporter chamber, we feel as if our full heads will burst. So will you, if you attempt to go back.
You mean magic?
Technology. What's the difference as far as we're concerned? What it means is that it's a one-way transporter. No one can leave by it.
No one?
No one. That's why the king's men don't use it.
Perhaps there's a little hope.
All looked at him, the big stranger who had been mainly silent. Marvin looked hardest.
Look, we're as much victims here as you are. But if the transporter is technology, or even if it's not... There may be a way.
How? You gonna kill off those head bees?
Maybe. The chamber beside the transporter chamber. I'm certain it didn't exist in any of the other frames.
Maybe there's something that will make the transporter two-way, possibly a control.
The King's men would have found it.
Maybe not. Not if they don't know what to look for. I remember how difficult it was to make a computer work when you didn't know the codes. You could make random guesses all week and never get anywhere, and the damn machine wouldn't tell you.
You think you know what to look for?
I might, if it's technology.
There'd better be an army in this. There'd better be, or that's the end of all of us.
Charlene woke up rested. The camp was quiet now, the wounded up and around. It was... good heavens, it was late in the day. She met Lomax as she was scrambling out of the tent. He was grinning as he came with arms wide for a hug. She let him embrace her and then tell her how many lives she had saved and how grateful they all were.
But now, we'll be making our big drive, and it's not fair to you.
You want me to leave?
Before we re-engage the enemy. Yes, ma'am. There will be more casualties, but we have a good supply of blood fruit, and you've discovered the mysteries of the doctor back. We can manage, although...
Yes?
Then you...
I will return home now, where I will be safe. That is what you were saying?
He looked astonished, then crestfallen. He had asked from a sense of duty.
I'm not really a nurse or a magician. I'm sure you will manage with those who assisted me. My daughter may need me, and then there's my son and his wife. Helm is having my grandson.
I see.
Keep the bandages changed, administer blood fruit syrup as needed, and keep that boy out of the fighting.
You mean Philip?
That's the boy. He's reckless as my John was at his age. I read his cards, and he's at continued high risk with the uncertainty card. Keep him safe.
I'll try, but Philip was a king. He's hard to control.
No harder, I suspect, than John. And Philip of Aratex doesn't have a big brother with magic gauntlets and a prophecy. If John was here, you'd know what unmanageable is.
Lomax tried to grin, albeit weak. He motioned to a passing soldier.
Corporal Hinzer, saddle Mrs. Charlene's horse and bring it to her. Have two unwounded men escort her to the border.
That won't be necessary. I know the way, and there shouldn't be any danger for one old woman.
Not old, but if you're sure...
You need all your men. The war isn't over.
Yes. Yes, thank you, Charlene. Thank you for your help. You've saved many lives.
Charlene waited patiently while her mount was brought, then climbed up and into the saddle. She was a little stiff from all that kneeling. She was about to ride out when Lomax came running to her, his face flaming red. He handed her up a packet and a jug.
I forgot you hadn't eaten. Here's traveling biscuit, dried meat, and tuber fruit. Wine's in the jug. You must be famished.
Not really. We witches seldom eat.
Witches?
It's what Philip said when I got to him. And who knows? If I had had a good teacher, he just might have been correct.
It was half a day later at leisurely horse-walking speed that she met the cat. It came from the bushes, tail raised, yellow eyes fixed on her, and she knew instantly that this was why she had left the camp.
Whoa, Nelly.
The cat turned its back, looked over its shoulder once, flicked its tail, and proceeded up a path.
Follow that cat, Nelly.
Eventually, the path reached its end, and they stopped. Here, in an otherwise empty glade, was a huge gnarled tree. Under the tree, waiting, was an old bent woman, leaning on a stick. Now, who would that be? Except...
Helba? Helba the witch?
Who else, Charlene?
I am here... Here, as I know, you directed.
You have done well. Now you will do even better.
Helen watched behind half-hooded eyes as John added seeds and crumbs to the tray on the windowsill. Her task done, John glanced at her, saw her apparently asleep, and tiptoed out. No sooner was the door closed than Helen was out of bed and scuttling, a way she found natural of late, across the room to the window. She stood stealthily waiting until the dark-headed sparrow lit on the tray's rim. Bright-eyed, the little bird regarded her carefully. Helen remained frozen, unblinking. Instantly, Helen's hand shot out like a snake. Her fingers snapped close like jaws on the tiny bird before it could flutter. She raised it to her mouth, her stomach growling for sustenance. Helen opened her mouth, easily, without seeming volition. Her head snapped forward, her teeth closed on the bird, and crushed it. She was just swallowing and brushing crimson stains from her lips when John entered.
Why, Helen, what? An egok dropped on a sparrow, and I tried to get here and chase it away, but...
Oh, Helen, how terrible for you.
I know how you love songbirds, how you enjoy seeing them. To have an egok drop one right on the tray.
It was only following its nature.
Yes, I know, but Helm, did you hurt yourself?
Bit my tongue when I tried to shout at the prey bird.
Without another glance at John, she got back into bed.
Don't you want to go for a walk this morning?
No!
But it's so nice out.
Helm merely closed her eyes as if bored with John's presence, which was hardly an exaggeration. John moved to her side and felt her forehead.
You have no temperature, Helm. You seem cool. Cooler than I'd think natural.
You ever been with child?
You know I haven't.
That's the way it is. For round ears, at least.
Oh.
I might take another cup of teafy.
I'll pull the cord for the servant. Would you like to eat something too, Helm? You hardly touched your groats this morning. Are you sick again?
No, I told you, I'm all right.
Two of John's fingers reached out to the corner of Helm's mouth. They picked out a tiny feather. John eyed it. And her.
I was too close to the kill. Blood and feathers sprayed on me.
Yeah, that must have been it.
John hesitated, giving Helm a peculiar look, then exited.
So good to be rid of that one, if only momentarily.
At the same moment, she felt the scuttling inside. Reaching down, she patted her bulging stomach.
Don't fret, little three heads. Mama will feed you well.
St. Helens heard them talking through the thick door. Then their jailer had the door open, and they were coming inside.
I'm Kildee, General Riley. I'm Klingland's monarch. I'm Kildum. I'm King of Khans. It is our hope that you will agree to come over to us.
You mean, switch sides?
That would be appropriate, General Riley.
In what way would it be appropriate? I'm a soldier, and I do what's required of me.
General Riley, you are not a bad man.
Thank you. I try not to be, though with imperfect success.
But your side is bad. There is a prophecy. We know of it from Helba.
You know about the prophecy? The one concerning the round ear?
Yes, concerning Kelvin of Kelvinia.
Then you know that there is little to be done to alter it.
Perhaps in reality, but not in truth. Uniting four may not mean uniting through warfare the kingdom of Kelvinia with those of Klingland, Khans, and Hermandy.
No. Well, what then does it mean?
Prophecies can be devious, Helba says, and subject to interpretation.
You don't think it would mean uniting Kelvinia with the remaining three kingdoms? Thrud is where every warring kingdom goes for mercenaries and weapons, while Ophel and Rotternik haven't even been penetrated since before Muvar's visit. As far as latecomers like me are concerned, those kingdoms might not even exist.
Nevertheless, Kelvinia may not have to conquer us.
Don't tell me you want to surrender.
Kildum looked at Kildee and shrugged. Kildee returned the shrug. They both looked back at him. They waited.
Well, is that what you want?
It is, General Riley. We have discussed the matter out of Helba's hearing, and we are prepared to raise the surrender flags.
St. Helens felt floored. In his wildest dreams, he had never anticipated this. They were play-acting. They had to be. But suppose they weren't.
You really want to surrender? Why?
To save us. To end the fighting. And to save our Helba.
Those would be your terms? Your only terms?
Yes, General Riley.
Wow.
Will you take our surrenders, General Riley?
I'll have to think about it, Your Majesties. I'll have to think things over.
Now they were gaping. It seemed that they had never imagined that he would demur.
Please, close the door tightly as you leave. I don't want to escape, and I don't want anyone rescuing me.
The two exchanged another glance. Maybe they did understand. Certainly they knew that he was on the wrong side. They left, leaving him with his chaotic thoughts. Kelvin hung suspended above the ledge, watching for the king's guardsmen. The updraft from the cliff was shockingly strong, much more than there had been in the other frame. He trusted his levitation belt, but this was a balancing act that made him a bit nervous. The chamber was to the left of the transporter chamber. No sign of it either from here or the ledge. He would have to just step through the rock face at the right spot and find himself in either the transporter or up against guardsmen with swords. There was really no choice except to trust the gauntlets. He landed on the ledge facing the cliff face. Was he following the guidance of the gauntlets properly? He drew his sword.
All right. I'm a hero.
As though annoyed, the gauntlets yanked him forward into rock that vanished. He was in a chamber lit by the glow. It was otherwise unoccupied and sparsely furnished for the comfort of vigil-keeping guardsmen. He put his head out the shimmering blue curtain in time to see his father pulling himself up the ladder at the cliff's edge. Below him was Kyan, and below Kyan were the others.
Guardsmen back there! 6 of them! Redleaf got him with his crossbow. Good man, that. He picked them off so fast and at such a distance that they never knew what happened.
Kyan came up, followed by Hester. Then the rest of them followed.
All right, there's no going near that transporter. But that anteroom where the guardsmen go is another matter. Have you been there, Sonny?
It's empty. As I told you, no guardsmen. I made certain, just as we agreed.
Well, let's have a look.
John disappeared into the rock face and Kelvin followed. One by one, the others joined them. Every wall felt solid, with the exception of one spot at the far end where there was a flat area with a transparent section at eye level. Looking through this window, as his father would have called it, Kelvin saw the transporter.
I don't see any button or lever in here, or in there. Give your gauntlets an order, Kelvin. Let them search.
Kelvin was quick to comply. The gauntlets did search, just as he mentally told them to, but they did not find anything on the flat area or its window.
Well, I suppose I can get used to living here. But I'm going to miss my wife, and the Chimera is going to think ill of me. I wanted to get the seeds for it. I'd promised. And I always keep my word.
Stupid mortal, relax and let the gauntlets do your work.
Mervania? Is that you?
What other head would it be, stupid? You must have known I'd keep track of you.
But you don't have the dragon berries.
No, but I do have a mind. The mind is not limited in intelligence species.
But if you found me and...
I have stayed with you. If I had let go, I would have lost you for good. Oh, I must admit I am growing tired of it. You are most boring. You don't like bloodletting at all. You wouldn't even have had the ferocity to attack those guardsmen if the gauntlets and I hadn't urged you on.
What do you want me to do, Mervania?
Kelvin hated to admit it, but he felt better having her along. His mind did feel inferior at times.
Why, thank you, Kelvin. You are quite correct. Your mind requires buttressing. Oh, very well. I will tell you what to do. Bring the entire crew here to my frame. I can help them.
You could eat them.
Oh, stupid mortal. Of course I could, but I won't. I want those seeds you're going to get. Then I won't need to cling to your frail mind in order to travel across the frames.
But why help these others?
Because I'm a good creature, that's why. You assume I'm evil merely because my dietary habits differ slightly from yours. That is a narrow view. Besides, I don't like tyrants. I've eaten a lot of them, and believe me, every time their minds gave my stomach trouble.
You've eaten tyrants?
Of course. You don't think I was always confined, do you? All humans are devourable. But some are tastier than others.
She likes to play with our food. Actually, it was only a couple of tyrants. One proclaimed itself a god, and the other built pyramids of human skulls. Now there's a delicious thought.
Merton, don't mess with my concentration. It's tedious enough keeping such a tiny mind online. Grumpus, what is it that you're chomping? Spit it out! Do you want to make us sick?
Then the gauntlet pressed his fingers against either side of the window. The flat area slid away, taking the window with it. There was now an open doorway between them and the transporter.
What did I tell you? Holy...
John clutched first his temples and then the front and back of his head. This was the head-splitting effect they had been warned about.
Oh, well, I'm certainly not going to put up with this. Get yourself out of it, stupid mortal. I'm leaving.
No, Mervania, wait.
Abruptly, he felt her presence, but not an end to the pain. She had made good on her threat. The gauntlets, unperturbed, were feeling carefully above the doorway.
You want to use that transporter? Go ahead.
Marvin charged clumsily toward the front of the chamber. His men quickly followed. Kelvin was growing faint, but the gauntlet suddenly pressed hard on a round area above his head. It was a flat, dark spot where the top of the door had been.
You've done it! Now we can go!
Not without us. You're going to help us, remember?
Well, of course we'll go together. You'll get your help, Marvin, just as my son promised. My son always comes through.
Gotta admit he's doing that. First two of you transport, then my men, and you and I last. Agreed?
It'll be a bit startling to see. We'll step in, there'll be a purple flash, and then we'll be gone.
What's it like to experience? Does it hurt?
No, it doesn't hurt. You'll find out what it's like soon enough. Just follow me.
As boldly as though it were just an everyday occurrence, he stepped into the adjoining chamber. His gauntlets didn't tingle, so he walked over to the transporter. There he found the Chimera's sting that he had apparently dropped and left.
What's that? Copper?
Yes, there's a lot of it where we're going.
Copper? Lots of copper?
Yes.
It's rare here. It's our most valuable metal. One copper coin is worth 3 gold or 2 silver.
We'll get you copper. Enough to buy your army. You do want that army.
Want it? I'd kill for it.
Kelvin stepped with faked confidence into the transporter. He was confident that it would work, but not about the rest of this misadventure. Blorg was waiting. In his hand was his copper sting, point on the metal floor. Kelvin nodded to him and waited also, feeling that it was the thing to do. The square ear could pick up from his mind what was going on. Soon, they were all there, with the exception of his father and Marvin. Then John Knight stepped from the transporter and the group leader. Marvin's eyes widened as he looked at Blorg. His hand went to his sword.
Don't! The square ears are in control!
Copper!
You were to bring the Chimera its seeds.
We reached the wrong frame.
My fault. I'm sorry. Even after you told us the setting.
I told you the setting for your own world. You disobeyed.
I was there. I went to our home world for the seeds. They were not where Muvar left them. I'm certain we can get the seeds, but it will take time to find the berries and harvest them.
So you came back empty-handed?
Yes.
Who are these others?
From the world we reached by error. They have a purpose in being here. The Chimera was in touch with me mentally. The Chimera approved their coming.
The Chimera does not make policy. The Chimera does not make law.
But...
You have disobeyed by returning here without the seeds. You have broken law by bringing others.
I'm sorry. The cost of our returning was that we helped these people. You see, they have a tyrant and...
Keep your mind still.
Kelvin knew that Blorg was getting the story from him, and he hoped he was getting it right. There were so many things that he himself did not understand. For instance, why had the transporter been one way until the gauntlets made it functional?
Muvar has his reasons. The people of that frame were not and are not ready. The transporter was for others.
Muvar watches over us all, doesn't he?
You too are not ready.
Kelvin did a mental shrug. In time, maybe, his kind would be considered adults by the like of Blorg and the Chimera. For now, they were children or animals who weren't ready yet to learn.
Precisely. Animals. Mentally inferior life forms.
Oh.
Marvin and his fellows had their swords drawn.
No square-headed foreigner calls me an inferior life form.
Blorg waved a hand. The blades glowed red.
They have powers. In many ways, they're more advanced than we are. They have magic here, while in worlds like yours and my father's, there's only technology.
Do you know what you're talking about?
Not really. Only that it's well to do what Blorg says.
My hand. It's burned. It's burned bad.
Is it, Marvin Loaf?
Blorg's hands did marvelously strange tricks, the fingers twining and untwining like snakes. One finger snapped out at Marvin and made a circle of all his men.
It's stopped. It's not burned anymore.
Mine neither.
Or held the strangers from the wrong frame transfixed, silencing them.
Now that little demonstration is over, we can proceed with business. The Chimera had no authority from me to do what it did. The Chimera deserves to be punished.
More than it has been? More than being confined to one little island?
Quite right. The Chimera shaped your thoughts, and you spoke them as your own.
The Chimera was getting him and all of them into more trouble.
Wrong. I am quite aware of the Chimera's reasoning in this matter. But I do not understand why it wants to give up its supply of copper to these simple beings.
Because...
Kelvin knew that this was the Chimera's thought, and that Blorg would recognize it as such.
I am tired of being a target. Every inferior life form with access to a transporter comes after my shed stings. I don't need them now, especially if I can locate others like myself. All I need is enough copper in my diet to keep from growing pale and weak and unmetallic. These round ears had a one-way transporter and can have it again. Let them take the copper to their own world and keep it there, confined. Whenever I shed an old sting, they can have that as well. Then let the inferior life-form poachers go to that world to steal the copper. They will discover that they are as much prisoner as I am.
That's very commendable, Nirvania.
Now Marvin Loaf's face changed as he caught on to what was happening. Perhaps the Chimera had touched his mind too, with a bit of explanation.
But what about the sting you now have? Your kind have been slain through the centuries for single stings. Indeed, the robot Stapula would have slain you earlier had he not been waiting for your latest sting to mature. That was why he was able to deceive me. I assumed that since he allowed his living companions to be slain, he had no weapon sufficient to harm you. Surely there will be other poachers.
That is why I am confined to an island, and why you guard the transporter. I expect you to do a better job in the future.
That might reduce the number and strength of expeditions, Mervania, once it is widely known.
It will be. And if the transporter is kept locked, and Marvin Loaf's outlet, and these inferior life forms do not use the sting in magic...
We won't. We don't even believe in that stuff. Much. All we want is the copper. Any horse-rear poachers come for it, we'll know what to do with them.
Agreed.
Agreed.
Grip my hands tighter. Let your essence and mine mingle.
Charlene tried to do as directed. The glade, the trees, the animals peering on, even the aged face all blurred. It was the dizzying twirl Helba had made her do, and that bitter wine. Now her arms and legs felt numb, her fingers tingled. She was Helba's hands, Helba's arms, Helba. Where did Charlene end and Helba begin? She could feel her heart beating in Helba's chest, feel the pain of Helba's reopened wound, feel the blood seeping through her black, satiny wrapper.
Helba! Helba, I'm you!
We're. Notice which mouth you're speaking from.
She had spoken from a nearly toothless mouth with sagging cheeks. Helba's. But when Helba spoke, it was from a mouth that had all its teeth and was perfect except for a bitter aftertaste.
We can do it now. Concentrate.
Charlene tried to remember. Her legs and arms jerked her over to the huge tree, over to the big crystal sealed in its hollow. Her eyes fixed on its surface, then below. Murky smoke swirled and twirled, then. Soldiers fighting. Klingland uniforms against Kelvinian uniforms. In the background, through clouds of dust, the huge dome of the Klingland capital.
Hurry! Hurry!
They had to be helped. They had to be given new strength. She could almost feel the weakness in those red uniformed arms. She wanted them stronger, stronger, stronger. Their minds and bodies refreshed. It was like a great wind blowing through her, out of her, into the crystal, into the bodies and minds of the defending soldiers. A green uniformed soldier was knocked from his saddle with a broad sweep of a defender's sword. Now another, and another. The green uniformed men were going down like harvested stalks of grain. Now they were panicking, turning, running. Their horses' hooves raised dust as they rode into their dust, pursuing them, chasing them, forcing them to keep retreating and not turn back.
Now! Now! Now!
Dust rose, twirled, blurring twin capital domes, city, hills, forest, big hills, bigger hills. Another army, green uniforms with a few black uniforms, bigger than the force driven from Klingland's capital, fighting soldiers wearing the bright orange uniforms of Kantz. The green uniforms and the black uniforms were winning. Orange uniforms lay with dead or dying bodies in them in the valleys and across the hills. There was no doubt the orange clads were being driven back, closer and closer to the twin capitals.
This must not happen.
Strength, strength, strength surging through her arms, out of her arms, to the bodies and minds of the defending warriors. More and more the orange clad struck down their opponents and fought with renewed force. Now the orange had stopped retreating. Now the armies were facing each other in unyielding lines. The Kantz army was fighting well now, but remained outnumbered. No matter how hard the orange fought,
They were certain to be cut down in the end. They had to have help. Magic help. Witch's help. With an intensity she had not imagined she had, Charlene felt the buildup, the great ballooning of rage in her body, in her soul, growing, growing, growing. She believed the mechanism to be good and just, yet the force was so strong she could not begin to control it. In the crystal, above the armies, there developed a great roaring ball of flame. All fighting stopped. The soldiers of both armies looked up. The blacks and the greens trembled. With a sudden swoop, the ball shot over the invading army. It descended. Little tendrils of flame grew out of its sides, reaching down, touching, burning, crisping as it sped. Men cowered and threw away their fire-hot weapons. The horses bolted for elsewhere. The ball imploded. Sparks showered down on the Kelvinian army. The Kansians charged, encouraged by the panic in the enemy resulting from the witch's fire. They met little fighting resistance. Their swords swung freely, their spears darted. Men, good, bad, and indifferent, choked and died.
Vesta.
Charlene felt herself falling. She felt her face against the ground. She felt blades of grass in her nose and tickling her ears. She felt that she herself was dying.
Oh, what have I done? What have I done?
You did what had to be done. What I had to do. And you had to help me do.
But all that killing. All that death.
This is the idiocy of men. We cannot redefine their nature. We can only intercede to enable the right side to prevail.
So Anna stared at the crystal with disbelief. The Kelvinian fighting men and the pick of Hermandy's fighting men were being routed.
Helba!
In the crystal, a burst of witchfire formed above the Kelvinian army. Men fell from their horses, grass browned in places, and the mud from a recent rain dried.
Damn her! Damn!
The crystal's image swirled and opaqued without her willing it. The opacity vanished, leaving a clear crystal with Helba's grimly wrinkled face inside.
Helba, I'll get you! I'll finish you!
Will you, Joanna? Try.
The challenge was too much. Joanna raised her hand, spoke the words of power, and sent forth a ball of fire. It backfired. She was thrown across the room, flat on her back amid a pile of smoking furniture and room furnishings. Joanna focused on the crystal. There was Helba's image with a pleased expression.
Helba, you're strong.
Stronger than you, Joanna.
We can become allies. We can become...
You are going to leave this frame forever. You and your imposter of a monarch are to vanish, leave on your own or be destroyed.
You can't threaten me, you old bag of bones.
Joanna, I do not threaten. I, far more than you, have the power to destroy.
Prove it. Prove it, you old hag.
Certainly, Joanna.
In the crystal, the aged face was replaced by a gnarled hand. The fingers separated, spreading to their maximum. Behind the hand, on a level with it, were two deeply burning feline eyes.
No, no, no!
Yes, yes, yes!
The crystal grew pink, then rosy. Belatedly, Joanna tried to put up some mind screen to abate what was happening. She had become so enraged that she had neglected to ready her defense. The crystal turned black and cindery, then it imploded.
Damn you, Helba! Damn you!
What's the matter, dear?
Rofrith had chosen this moment to come casually strolling into this wing of the palace. He appeared unperturbed by the disorder, and in fact, he seemed hardly to have noticed it.
Oh, you! It's your fault!
That it is, dearie.
Rofrith was speaking in Helba's voice. So Anna stared at him, appalled.
Goodbye, wicked woman.
Then her projection faded, leaving only Rofrith standing there with a bewildered expression. So Anna gazed for some time at the vacant spot where the crystal had been. She realized that on this occasion, she had been out-magicked and bested. She had underestimated Helba and thought her dying and finished, and so ignored her. That had been a colossal mistake. The witch had survived and recovered and gathered her magic for an effective retaliation. Well, Joanna could do that too. One more visit to Professor Duval, and she would be ready.